liberation came to Singapore and Malaya on September the 12th, 1945. It was already a fact in Burma. Liberation to Southeast Asia meant more than the defeat of Japan. It meant the unleashing of a surge of hope, the stimulation of dreams of nationhood, a new future. All these ideas entered the realm of possibility on the day the Japanese forces made their surrender in Singapore to the Supreme Allied Commander, Admiral Lord Louis Mountbatten.
I now find myself in a totally new role. At the end of the surrender ceremony in Singapore, I ceased to be a fighting commander. The problems I now had to deal with were political and human problems, and on a terrifying scale.
The rescue of prisoners of war and civilian internees from the Japanese prisons and prison camps was the most urgent task of the liberating forces. There were nearly 250 of these camps. The first need was to locate them. The second, to rush in medical supplies and food. The third, to get the men out.
Edwina was superintendent in chief of the St. John Ambulance Brigade and chairman of its joint war organization with the Red Cross. She'd already had a large hand in the recovery of Allied prisoners of war from Germany, so it would be fair to call her an expert on the problem. When I was in London after the Potsdam Conference, I asked her to come out and deal with it in our part of the world.
Accompanying Lady Mountbatten on many of these dangerous missions was her private secretary, Mrs. Elizabeth Collins.
I joined her in Kandy in 1945, then off to Sumatra, where there was much sickness and where the prisoners had to be evacuated as quickly as possible, and where Lady Mountbatten directed the major part of the work from the camps. She had to give her orders to the heavily armed Japanese officers, who soon realized that here was somebody with the most amazing drive and ability, and if she said a thing had to be done, then it had to be. They had thousands of troops covering the areas because she was the first person who arrived in these camps. She worked 16 hours a day non-stop and then started her paperwork in the middle of the night. As for the prisoners themselves, she had that terrific magical quality which I can't describe, but they also realized that here was a most sincere person and a very practical one who would get on with the job and who had brought help to them after those 3.5 years of captivity.
I am sure that Edwina saved countless lives by her tireless personal activity. And although I'm speaking about my own wife, I must add that I consider it was a heroic effort. I was just 45 years old when I took on this great responsibility. Now, from Government House, Singapore, I found myself ruling over an enormous area. Before the Potsdam Conference, I had been responsible for Burma, Malaya and Singapore, Siam and Sumatra. Now, I was also responsible for all the rest of the Dutch East Indies as far as New Guinea, but French Indochina only up to the 16th parallel. The whole of this vast area was in a state of utter administrative chaos, and many of its 128 million inhabitants were facing imminent starvation. The reports that poured into me daily in Government House, Singapore, were more and more depressing. The French and Dutch territories were our worst headache by far. They presented a double problem. We were obliged to hand back their overseas possessions to our French and Dutch allies without really knowing what their policies for these areas were going to be or how these areas were going to receive them. In French Indochina, maintaining Laos, Cambodia, and the state now known as Vietnam, the power vacuum produced a situation of complex danger. In 1945, the Japanese had overthrown the last vestiges of Vichy French authority. Now, there was a contest for power. The nationalist leader was Ho Chi Minh, who had set up the Viet Minh, that's the League for the Independence of Vietnam in Exile, in China in 1941. Now, Ho Chi Minh had returned to end French rule. The Americans, following their anti-colonial policy, backed him, although he was a communist. The British felt obliged to support their French allies and at least keep order until French policy was clarified. I had assumed I'd be responsible for the post-surrender tasks in the whole of French Indochina, and had provisionally earmarked an infantry division for Hanoi as well as Saigon. But the Allied leaders at Potsdam decided otherwise. They divided French Indochina along the 16th parallel of latitude and gave the northern part to Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, who was then thought to represent China. This seemed utterly stupid, because Vietnam and Laos should clearly have been treated as entities. But I could do nothing about it except watch the growing confusion in the north with increasing apprehension. After a time, Free French troops under their famous general Leclerc arrived, and the problem now became theirs. But the division along the 16th parallel was already revealed as a disaster. The French War in Indochina followed, and much later the American War. So the world has suffered much from this Potsdam decision.
Pandit Nehru, the most distinguished figure in the Indian interim government, came to Singapore to study the conditions of the large Indian community and meet the Indian forces there. It would be hard to think of a more fateful meeting. It could easily have gone terribly wrong. Nehru had just been in prison for opposing our war effort. One of the things he was supposed to do was to lay a wreath on the memorial to the Indian National Army, who'd fought against us. In fact, his whole visit could have developed into a vast anti-British demonstration. Not very nice to think about when you consider that the bulk of our forces here were Indians. This man was clearly going to be Prime Minister of India. The local authorities hadn't even arranged to let Nehru have a car, so I lent him mine. We brought hundreds of Indians into Singapore in army trucks to see him. I received him immediately at Government House and then drove with him through the streets where he had a fantastic welcome. That night, I invited him to dinner with us. It was a very happy little party. I was able to persuade him not to lay the wreath on the pro-Japanese Indian National Army Memorial. And in fact, his whole 9-day visit passed off very well, without any unpleasantness of any description or any disturbance. This really was a stroke of fate. It was the beginning of a deep friendship between Jawaharlal Nehru and Edwina and myself. How important this was going to be, of course, I couldn't possibly guess. But the value of establishing this link was obvious enough. It helped to wipe out the bitterness of the past. But what I value above all is the lasting friendship we formed.
The Mountbatten talent for friendship soon found other outlets. A few days after meeting Nehru, Lord and Lady Mountbatten visited Australia and New Zealand at the invitation of the governments of those countries. The purpose of the visit was very similar to that of an earlier occasion, the Prince of Wales's tour in 1920. A goodwill tour, when Mountbatten witnessed the enthusiastic welcome of the Prince. Now he was the recipient of such a welcome, he and Lady Luhe. For as one Australian newspaper proclaimed in banner headlines, he's a beaut and she's even more of a beaut. Australians would be slow to forget the work that Lady Luhe had done for their prisoners of war in the Japanese camps. A visit in both countries was a triumph. But Mountbatten was still Supreme Allied Commander, Southeast Asia. His period of command was drawing to an end. In May 1946, the Right Honourable Malcolm MacDonald, also at Mountbatten's request, arrived as Governor General of Malaya and Singapore, and Mountbatten proudly handed over to him a fully functioning administration. For Mountbatten, in the second half of 1946, the time came when the returning warrior receives his due reward. For one who had done so much, the rewards were many. In London's historic Guildhall, he was presented with a Sword of Honour and the Freedom of the City.
The freedom of the City of London is by common consent the greatest civic honour in the British Empire. I am deeply appreciative of its bestowal on me today, and the Sword of Honour, which will be my most treasured possession, shall hang above that sword, which was surrendered to me by the Japanese Supreme Commander of the Southern Regions, Field Marshal Count Terauchi.
London's honors were followed by other valued freedoms, by honorary degrees, presidencies of distinguished organizations. Allied countries also added their accolade. At the Invalides in Paris, with full panoply, Mountbatten was invested with the Grand Cross of the Legion of Honor by France's famous fighting soldier, Marshal Juin. In October, the Mountbattens celebrated an event of different gratification, the marriage of their eldest daughter. The Honourable Patricia Mountbatten was 22 years old. Now she married her father's ADC, Sir John Knatchbull, 7th Baron Brabourne, whose father had been Governor of Bombay and Bengal and temporary Viceroy of India for 6 months in 1938. Once more, a Mountbatten wedding brightened the social scene. Mountbatten himself now had a new title, commemorating the great campaign conducted under him, Mountbatten of Burma. It commemorated also his first passage through the dangerous waters of high politics. Mountbatten never pretended that he did not relish honors. Now a secret ambition was fulfilled. The king conferred upon him the most coveted award of all. With ancient ceremony, Mountbatten became a Knight of the Order of the Garter, his banner hanging in illustrious company in St. George's Chapel, Windsor.
Much as I come to love the East, it was with a sense of relief that I handed over this responsibility and came home. I was just on 46 years old. I was still in the Royal Navy. I'd just been promoted from substantive captain to rear admiral, and I very badly wanted to get back to sea.
In 1946, Britain's new Labour government made yet another attempt to preserve Indian unity. The British Prime Minister, Mr. Attlee, concluded that only a completely fresh approach could avert disaster. There would have to be, said Attlee, a change of bowling. He invited Mountbatten to take on the post of Viceroy.
When Mr. Attlee asked me to take on this job, he rather took my breath away. This wasn't something that could be decided straight off, and in fact, we had several meetings about it. I asked to see the king. As King Emperor, he kept very close touch with Indian affairs. I pointed out to him that the chances of complete failure were very great, and it would be bad for him to have a member of his family fail. He replied, "But think how good it would be for the monarchy if you succeed." And he then asked me formally to accept the appointment.
There had been appalling riots in Calcutta back in August 1946, with 5,000 dead and 15,000 injured. These were followed by other horrible massacres in other places. Now, in March 1947, as I was preparing to set out, there was virtual civil war in the Punjab. Faced with such facts as these, the sense of urgency took hold of me at once and never left me.
Mountbatten arrived in Delhi on March the 22nd. The occasion was marked by ceremonial dating back through nearly 100 years of viceregal pomp. At the top of the long flight of steps leading up to the Viceroy's house, the Viceroy-to-be was greeted by the Viceroy in office. The formalities denoted that for one more day, Lord Wavell, as the personification of the King Emperor, held the status of a monarch in this house. Mountbatten was sworn in. Now, all India's hopes and all her complexities lay in his keeping.
The
the British government had agreed to give me a time limit. Indian independence was to be achieved by June 1948. That was only 15 months off. 15 months then seemed a very short time for the transfer of imperial power. And the question, the enormous question, to which I had to find an answer as rapidly as possible was, to whom could we transfer our power? Our one desire was to preserve a united India. Could we do it? And if so, who would be its rulers? If the leaders of the Indian communities really couldn't resolve their differences, then there would have to be partition. A hated thought. And how was that to be carried out? The realities had a bleak look in March 1947.
Once again, Mountbatten's role was to grip a crumbling situation, to give the ship of state in India the sense of being steered again. The immediate task was to establish contacts with people, the key figures of Indian politics, and through them, with the people of India.
Far and away the most outstanding man in India, a world figure, and although a Hindu, revered by hundreds of millions of his fellow countrymen, Muslims and Hindus alike, was Mahatma Gandhi, known affectionately and reverently to them as Gandhiji. Gandhi's purely political power was on the wane. He was a modern-day saint, really, and saints can't thrive forever in a political atmosphere. We might not always be able to take Gandhi along with us, but we would get nowhere if he came out against us. When he started calling Edwina and me his dear friends, I began to have the feeling that we were halfway home. Nehru was already a friend, of course. The trust I was trying to build up with the leaders was already there, and more than trust, friendship. It was not only between him and me, but with Edwina and my daughters Patricia and Pamela too. He believed that our whole family loved India and would try and do what was right for India. Nehru was a great statesman. He had a brilliant mind. He was quite amazingly quick to grasp a point and very sensitive to situations. Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel was another tremendously important figure. Inside the Congress Party, he was just about as eminent as Nehru. Patel could be a great force for moderation, if he so decided. But if he didn't, he could be most dangerous. Our relationship improved, until in the end, we also became firm friends. Here again, the alternative would have been disastrous. We could never have hoped to make any headway against Patel's opposition. If it could be said that any single man held the future of India in the palm of his hand in 1947, that man was Muhammad Ali Jinnah. To all intents and purposes, Jinnah was the Muslim League. And if the dream of Pakistan, the separate Muslim state, ever did come true, it would be Jinnah who brought it to life and fashioned it. As I looked at each day's new results of communal discord, I realized that in their present mood, the religious groups were just not going to be able to live together. They were tearing their country to pieces. Well, if they wouldn't live together, then they would have to live apart. This was a realization which had been growing on me almost from the moment I came out here. I could sense a real tragedy just round the corner if we didn't act very fast. Civil war in its worst form. Beside that, partition, much as so many of us hated it, now seemed a much lesser evil. And so, our dream of handing on a united India had vanished. India would have to be divided, and this would have to happen before June 1948.
By indefatigable industry and inexhaustible tact, Mountbatten won the agreement of the Indian leaders to a new plan, the plan. On June the 3rd, at a historic and dramatic meeting, this agreement was put to the test. Right up to the last moment, there remained the chance that another clash of personality might wreck everything. But Mountbatten's grip did not falter. He firmly steered the Indian leaders towards acceptance of the plan, and with it, acceptance of the responsibilities of power.
Our plan amounted to this. There were to be two independent dominions, remaining within the Commonwealth, thank goodness. India, predominantly Hindu, in the middle. And because the Muslims were concentrated in two widely separated areas, a divided Pakistan, west and east. Jinnah wanted a corridor between the two parts, but we talked him out of that. The princely states, over 500 of them all told, would in theory become independent, but I urged them to accede to one or other of the two new dominions. All governmental assets, including the armed forces, the civil service and the police, would be divided between them. In disputed areas, a boundary commission would draw the actual frontiers. It was predictable that there would be areas which would be bitterly disputed, and there was bound to be trouble. But we had to have a plan and act on it. The only alternative was chaos.
This is how Mrs. Pandit remembers the event.
Looking back to 1947, one is apt to miss the intensity and the bitterness that existed in India at that time. And yet, in spite of what one has seen during these last 20 years, I have no hesitation in saying that the decision when it was taken was a perfectly genuine one, and one which the leaders of India thought was in the best interests of the future of the country.
The princes of India were in a pathetic situation. They belonged to the past, a remote past, and most of them had no idea of how to conduct themselves towards the people who are going to be India's new rulers. I saw the principal rulers separately. Then I summoned a full-scale meeting of the Chamber of Princes. I told them I wanted to make the best bargain for them that I could, but that after the 15th of August, I wouldn't be in a position to mediate for them anymore. So they must make up their minds now. I warned them solemnly against any thought of resorting to arms. I told them they couldn't run away from the new Dominion governments that were going to be their neighbors. They would have to live with them.
With independence now in sight, the pace of work for all concerned, already exhausting, became even swifter. The date, August the 15th, 1947, now became a target. August 13th, 1947. Only 2 days remained before Indians achieved their independence. But by the nature of the plan accepted, independence would mean two things, and the focus of attention would be in two places. For this was going to mean an independent India and an independent Pakistan. So on August the 13th, the Viceroy was not in Delhi, but in Karachi.
It was a great day for the Muslim League, and a great day for Mr. Jinnah, whose dreams had now come true. Now, he not only had an independent Muslim dominion, but he himself was about to be installed as the first Governor General of Pakistan. It was disconcerting, to say the least, to be aware all through the ceremonies in Karachi that there was a plot to throw a bomb at Jinnah as he drove back from the swearing-in. In fact, I tried to dissuade him from going through with the state drive, but he'd insisted on doing it. So I said I would accompany him. He then tried very hard to dissuade me, and it was my turn to insist. Anyway, there we both were, trying to look cheerful, as the vast crowds cheered us and cried out, Zindabad! Knowing all the time that somewhere among them there was at least one man with a bomb. For some reason he didn't throw it, so he got back to Government House safely. And Jinnah, in a moment of rare emotion, laid his hand on my knee and said, thank God I've brought you back alive. I thought this was a bit much, so I replied, thank God I've brought you back alive.
Delhi, August the 14th, 1947. Pandit Nehru addressed the Indian Constituent Assembly.
Long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny, And now the time comes when we shall redeem our pledge. At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom. A moment comes, which comes but rarely in history, when we step out from the old to the new, when an age ends, and when the soul of a nation, long suppressed, finds utterance.
Mission accomplished. It wasn't exactly the mission I'd come out to perform. I'd come out to see if there was a last chance of handing over to a united India. It turned out that there wasn't even a remote chance. We'd had to accept that. But it was a sad reflection. So I couldn't look on this day's achievement with completely undiluted pleasure. And then, too, there was a sense of the end of an epoch. 200 years of British rule in India, with all the tremendous memories that that implied. On the day I was installed, I said to Nehru, I want you to regard me not as the last viceroy winding up the British Raj, but as the first to lead the way to a new India. So now that it had all happened, that was the way I mostly felt about it. It wasn't an end, it was a beginning, an unbelievably happy beginning.
The high drama of August the 15th, the day of Indian independence, began for Mountbatten at the very opening of the day.
Shortly before midnight, on August the 14th, 1947, I was sitting at my desk, signing the last telegrams that would ever be sent from a Viceroy of India to a Secretary of State in London. When I had finished, I cleared the desk and waited. Then, soon after midnight, Pandit Nehru arrived with Rajendra Prasad, the president of the Constituent Assembly. Prasad told me formally that it was the wish of the Assembly that I should be India's first Governor General. I replied, I am proud of the honor, and I'll do my best to carry out your advice in a constitutional manner.
At 8:30 a.m. on August the 15th, Mountbatten was sworn in as the first constitutional head of the new India. In turn, he swore in the members of his government. The next act in a day of tumultuous excitement was an address to the Constituent Assembly. Then a drive back to Government House amid delirious crowds.